Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total photonic reversal.
Photonic reversal.
Protonic reversal with your host, Conan Neutron. Broadcasting from a secret underground lair in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
A gigantic middle finger to everything that is rock about music, rock and roll, and corporate power.
The thing is, though, if you don't laugh, you're going to go on a killing spree with sharpened nails.
Confidence of a hero or a fool, I wasn't exactly certain which.
Could not be more professional.
It means something.
And they got away.
You know, that's my take. Like, what's yours?
Protonic reversal.
That's like a science thing, right?
Indeed it is. It's a science thing. It's a science place. It's a scientific fact that we're all up in your face at this time. Once again, for the one, the only protonic reversal. Welcome to it. One last episode before I head out on tour. Very excited for this. This is cool. I'm going to be talking to Andrew from Nuzzle shortly, a band that you may not know, but has a very interesting story that I have an interesting connection to. We will get into that in mere moments when I start talking to him in earnest. But before we do any of that, welcome to Conan Neutron's Protonic Reversal. I'm your host, Conan Neutron, rock and roll lifer that's been touring and recording for 25 years, most known for the band Conan Neutron and the Secret Friends. Music's a huge part of my life, and I use the format of this very long-running podcast to talk about music with musicians whose work I enjoy and respect, but who may not be household names. This is episode 441. If this is your first time listening to the show, archives of it are available for free. No ads, no sponsors, no kidding at protonicreversal.com. However, if you want to support the show and get episodes sooner, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal will achieve that goal. If you like the show, even just a single episode, please feel free to like, subscribe on your platform of choice, share around the internet, even leave a review. All that helps people discover the show. It beats back the almighty algorithmic overlords. And it's just a darn nice thing to do. Okay, so before I get to Andrew and all things Nuzzle, I got to mention that at the time of this recording, next week we will be on tour from the 17th on all the way to Rat City Recon. So it's going to be Chicago, Minneapolis, Lincoln, Nebraska, Denver, Colorado, Salt Lake City, Boise, Idaho, Eugene, Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and then Seattle, Washington for Rat City Recon with Piss Jeans, Helmsley, Cherubs, so many more. It's going to be a great time. Come on out to the shows. I usually bring some Protonic Reversal stickers. I'll give them to you if you say the phrase that pays. And then of course in November, going out again, Kansas City, Jackson, Mississippi, Atlanta, New Orleans, Austin, Denton, Wichita, Santa Fe, and Phoenix. And then we have a show with Mike Watt at Redwood Bar in Los Angeles for my birthday. Stay tuned for all that. Songkick, Bandcamp, usually the best places to find out about Secret Friends stuff. Sometimes I even remember to mention on this show. It's what a time to be alive. Of course, We're the Neutron, neutronfriends.bandcamp.com, still out and available on all the things. Okay, enough about me. Let's talk about Andrew. Nuzzle's an interesting band. There is a reissue, a 30th anniversary edition of Follow For Now. Now, this is following up the Junk of Myth 1995 compilation that was put out. Good Lord, that can't possibly be 5 years ago. Wow, really? No. Come on. Lame. Okay. But before we get too deep into all that, let's bring him on right now. Let's bring on Andrew from Nuzzle. Andrew Dalton, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Con, how you doing?
Good. So I just flabbergasted myself that Junk of Myth comp was 5 years ago.
Quite a while ago.
That sucks. That feels like 5 weeks ago to me. Yeah, I don't know about you, but
yeah. And I can't believe you've been at this show for so long. Was it, what did you say, 441 here?
Yeah. It's 11 years in April. So I was doing this way before there was a video element. That's for darn sure.
Right. Yeah. No, I was just writing about in my day job, just writing about Mark Maron's last episode on Monday.
Oh yeah, that's it's like next week or something.
It's Monday, and yeah, he's not saying who it's going to be. But he did his last, like in his own garage episode.
Right.
He's going to be off somewhere.
End of an era. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I listened to the first of that, and it was definitely on an iPod for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure.
With the little wheel on it. You know,
you can't see. I would have to screw up my whole setup to show you, but I still have my original. Bought it all at Fry's Electronics. That tells you how old it is. Like setup that has like, you know, cables and like a mixer, et cetera, et cetera. I did swap out the audio interface about 3 years ago, but for a long time, I used the same audio interface I got in like 2007 or something. Cause like, I ain't broke. Don't fix it. You know? But there is this one that just is better, but I basically did the show the same way. 2020 during COVID, I started doing video without even like really thinking about it that much. And then like, there's this whole other audience that people now only know it through YouTube, and it's like, okay, well, that's like only one of the things that this is, but sure, whatever. I mean, technology evolves, right?
Sure. And is Fry's Electronics no more? Is the chain?
I don't think they showed up in did you see the Jordan Peele movie Nope?
Yeah,
it shows up there, but I want to say, because that's like slight period piece, I think they ceased operations February 24th, 2021. Yeah, they didn't make it.
I do remember visiting one what must have been very late in the LA area, and it was surreal because they still had so many sort of just spare parts, you know. Because
that was it, man.
That was the thing, and a weirdly good selection of candy in the mix. It was just so odd.
So I can tell you from some authority that is that during the when it was really packed, that's when they would move like all that like candy and snack food. You're like, you know, man, I'm hungry as hell. Like, okay, that Nestle's Crunch looks great right now. I'm gonna grab that, you know.
Yeah.
But Fry's Electronics, I mean, it's sort of like a true heads know kind of situation. If you were ever a tinkerer with hardware, I mean, it's like you say, it was just like there's just drawers of things everywhere.
It was like a dozen Radio Shacks at least, maybe like 20 or 30 Radio Shacks in one.
Imagine a Radio Shack was a mall.
Exactly.
And there you go.
Unto itself.
Although try explaining that to like a Zoomer now. Be like, wait, what are those words you just said?
I know exactly. The comparison doesn't do any good.
So tell me about George Chen, first of all, because I want to know how you originally got hooked up with George, because he's how I know of Nuzzle. And we'll get into the funny link between that in a minute. But tell me how you know George first.
George has been our kind of angel, both when we were together initially and since, just as far as getting us to do things. I always feel like we've never done quite enough to repay George, especially because we used to regularly flake on really good shows that he would set up for us. It's been I don't remember his first appearance in our lives. I do remember, you know, he was just around a ton when we were playing. We were playing a lot in we were based in Santa Cruz through most of our initial run. And so he was we would see him at shows in the Bay, and we would see him in San Jose. And it was so he put out I believe it was the last thing we did as Nuzzle. It was a 7-inch that was our first sort of official connection with him.
But then through Zero Units Move.
Yes, exactly.
Was a zine first, if I remember correctly.
Right, right. Yeah. And he was a, and then, you know, in the years since, he's been the biggest legacy is too strong a word, but he's been the biggest tender of our memory, you can say, you know, through putting out that comp, through, you know, he was the one who set up our Bandcamp page, he was in charge of our Spotify profiles, and which is all stuff that we would not have had without him, and that we've tried to take over a little bit lately. But
bring you into the modern age,
right?
Such as it is. Yeah, no, and George is someone that all respect. It's like there's some people you just always around doing good, like repping the things that he loved.
Yep.
And it's funny because him and I, you know, it's not like we were ever close friends, but so I was like, oh yeah, George Chen. We were doing the same sorts of things, like not necessarily in the exact same circles all the time. Right. And, you know, this is an objective force for good, you know, very, very.
Absolutely. Very, he's the guy that sets the thing up, but without being the slightest bit ornery about it, you know, without being any kind of, I mean, and just is always the, and just, you know, for guys like us who can tend to be a little bit lackadaisical, he was just he's just an essential person for reasons that, you know, that really just he never got any glory for and never got any benefit other than just getting to hang out with us, I suppose. But
yeah,
he's been fantastic for us. and then has a bigger role again now with this reissue, and which is part him and part this Solid Brass label we bought.
Sure, sure. And of course, Solid Brass, since founding, I've featured a lot of the bands that have the reissues that have come out on Solid Brass. I've featured a lot of them, and some of them being like legacy artists that like I really like. I'm like, yeah, I'll talk to those guys. That sounds great. Some being ones that I'm like less familiar with. I'm like, oh yeah, let me check this out. Okay, I missed that one. Right? You know, it's all really cool stuff.
Yeah, and I love that they've gone after older people that we thought, you know, might be worthy of this treatment that maybe didn't even make that big a mark then, and then they're doing newer bands, and they also just came out, you know. Our initial reissue we did was one of the first things they did. And, you know, usually a label starts very slowly unless it's, you know, but they just jumped on, you know, they got this running start and have just been churning stuff out.
The Kerosene 454 reissue. Camera Obscura. I mean, there's been all kinds of like really cool. I mean, because when you mentioned Camera Obscura, it's like, yeah, I love that band. But it's like,
yeah.
But I'm talking about the San Diego band, not the one that the indie rock band. And I was like, well, yeah, of course. Like, there's another band, you know, like for me in my limited worldview, I'm like, oh, they're huge. Whoops. I guess there is. Okay.
Right. And the Sleepy Time Trio now, which was one of my favorite, them and Kisses and Hugs were my two favorite, like, you know, ferociously rocking bands with sweet little names.
Right. Exactly. Where it sounds like, oh, how sweet. Oh, no, not sweet at all. So tell me about the world like Nuzzle came up in, because you guys were like almost a class above me. Like not, I always say that like all the Boner Records crew, like Steel Pole Bathtub and like Melvins in their Bay Area incarnation are really a class above me. But I felt like just as I was starting to get going, you guys were starting to wind down a little bit, which we'll get to a funny crossover point for that later. But tell me how it all kind of came together at first and when you operated.
Yeah, we were all, all went to the same high school in Rosemead, California, which is one of those, you know, kind of small cities that's like right near downtown LA, but nobody knows about, you know, including in LA, you know, maybe the immediate neighbors and that's it. Like the teams that play with football and that's it. So it's this weird combination of urban and, you know, there's a lot of places in California like this, but weird combination of urban and, but with a oddly kind of small town vibe. And we knew each other. Well, you know, my brother and I were both in it, so obviously we've known each other since his birth. But as a quartet, we did know each other in high school and liked each other in high school. But we went to high school together, but we weren't a crew then. There was a lot of it was one of those things where we got close right after it ended, and kind of retroactively wished we'd been, you know, all close friends.
Sure,
all would have had a much better experience than we did, I think.
Yeah,
and kind of had spent a lot of time lamenting why we weren't hanging out sooner, you know, and would have probably enjoyed ourselves quite a bit more. So that was a thing. I left for college at UC Santa Cruz reluctantly by the time I went, because we were a quartet, and the other three guys were playing, started playing together that summer right after I was in high school. My little brother was still in high school, and the other two guys had graduated not long before also. So that started happening. I left for Santa Cruz, and they were like a trio that was just playing parties and stuff here in LA, and really gelled together. Sam, our bass player, and Nate, they'd known each other a little bit better through high school, and had been playing together a little bit. And then adding our drummer Rick, who they, you know, again, who was a guy that we knew pretty well, but wasn't a close friend. Like they started playing together at a party where he'd been playing with another band, and it was just a really magical evening that I had to hear about on the phone and kind of missed being there. Even though I didn't really play an instrument, wouldn't have had a clear role, but like I was like just as the guy. So I, you know, they would play. I would come down as much as possible when I could. I was kind of just their hype man. I would come up and maybe sing one song, and then do a lot of, you know, be the guy in the front row. Through that. And then I ended up just because it was felt so inevitable. I ended up, you know, my brother started writing some really, really cool songs. And while I was still stuck up there at college, and, you know, I ended up joining, just because I had to be part of it. I picked up a guitar. We were a part of a scene where you weren't expected to be able to play all that well. It helped.
Did you figure it out while you're doing it? Yeah, exactly.
There was lots of that. And so, you know, we ended up, and it was kind of a long distance relationship a little bit between Santa Cruz and LA. Mm-hmm. And a story I've told too many times, I did, you know, end up, we're okay, but I ended up at a, we played on a radio show at KSPC here, Claremont College. Is it?
I know well.
I was now a good friend, and I broke a string during set and had no clue how to even start to change it, and kind of in a way that I do. Everyone else in the band is really chill, but I can be a bit of a tantrum throwing baby. I kind of lost a little bit, and afterward, I asked my brother if I could just sing, which hadn't really. So many of the bands that we liked before, which were a lot of those kind of AMRAP bands and stuff, there weren't usually singers separately. You know, it wasn't. We didn't think of it as that much of a thing. A lot of the bands that we ended up playing around, you know, had that going on. So it just made sense. And as soon as we made that change, it just everything just really gelled perfectly. And we realized it was a thing that we were gonna, you know, do a lot more with. We had a lot of people ask us the first show that we did that way, what the hell happened to you guys? And it was just like, it wasn't that I was doing anything particularly, you know, impressive. It was just that it was just the right roles for everybody.
And that's changed the dynamic. You know,
yeah, and I do my best, you know, like as the kind of I'm the, by far the biggest talker, and so I'm the one who does interviews like this, and much the same way. I mean, my brother's the songwriter, and I think we all regard him as the talent that we all, you know, sort of glom onto, but he is not fond of doing stuff like this,
right. And not everybody is
fond of facing forward. And at first, wasn't even fond of facing forward on stage. He was a classic, like, you know, behind the amp kind of guitarist, and I almost considered myself kind of his public facing half. And
the word I use is human ambassador.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know this well, and it's funny that you mentioned that too, because if you think about from the world of rock music, it's like, okay, you know, the singer, guitar player, bass player, and drummer is like, that's the default. The world of punk rock though is pick up an instrument, do something.
And right, exactly.
And I feel like though it's weird to describe for folks that are a little younger, because there's so much more intermeshing and crossover. I mean, do you remember when like the metalheads and the punk rockers were like completely distinct and different entities and never shall the two meet except for like Motorhead?
Exactly. We could all agree on Motorhead.
Everybody likes Motorhead, yeah.
Slayer. No, that was a huge thing. I mean, it was really, and there was, it felt like there was some, you know, defining yourself as we didn't dislike the metal kids, but it was, they were not,
well, it just, they were, it's not fine.
The same world. We ended up playing the same show. It was like, really?
Do we have to? Right. You know? And that just is not a thing anymore. Which that is not
fantastic.
A thing. Yeah, that's, I mean, and that's, you think about it, you're like, why? You know, like, it doesn't make any sense. But at the time, it's like, well, no, that's they're into these bands. We're into these bands. It's like, dude, of all the people in this school, like, nobody knows about these bands except for all of you nerds. So
right. And I, you know, I do find that there's weirdly a little bit more like kind of genre description, cataloging, that kind of thing. But it's not a social class. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, here it's like post math, whatever. And like, but they all end up in the same mix, and bands would play together, and the walls aren't there.
Well, and it's funny because for me, when Nuzzle did come to my attention, it was sort of like, oh, this is sort of like a cross between like some like the cool Gravity Records stuff that I like those bands, and then also kind of like the Pacific Northwest, you know, Kill Rock Stars kind of vibe. You know, Unwound looms very large in my life, as they do for many of us that are West Coast folks. And it was something where I feel like there weren't tons and tons. I guess it was lowercase, right? But there wasn't like tons and tons of bands around that time that were operating in the milieu. It was more like, okay, these are the punk rock bands, you know, these are the noise bands, these are the indie rock bands. And the indie rock bands were like, oh no, but this is like indie pop, not indie rock. Like, this is very different, which isn't to say those bands are bad, like far from it. It's just like, no, it's not really what this band does. And it was interesting because, because I found out about you guys basically as it was just almost over. And the reason why I found out about you guys is I bought your old van.
Oh my goodness.
So your old tour van was my first van, and indeed the first vehicle I ever owned, I might add.
Wow. Of any kind, you went straight to van. That's impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was this the yellow one, I assume?
It was a white extended length.
That one. That one, yes, of course.
And it was because my band Replicator just started doing stuff. And so, okay, we're doing stuff, like we need to drive there. And I had lived in the Bay Area. So if you live in the Bay Area, you don't really need, you know, you can get around through BART and bus and just walk places.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was, I bought the old Nuzzle van. So the old Nuzzle van became the first Replicator van that didn't, yeah, we got like maybe like a year or two of use.
That's a long time for such a thing. Was there an intact loft still?
There absolutely was. Yes.
That's awesome.
So
I still miss that. I miss that as just like a camper type thing. Not that I go camping, but I'm just saying
lie in the back
and face up. And if you faced up, you could kind of read or stuff that you might not be able to. You'd get car sick if you're facing forward.
The annoying thing now for us, I don't know the noise. In order to do what we do, we have to sell a lot of merch. So it's like there's so many merch bins, we can't really have a loft.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a problem. Oh my God, we used to clown on pop punk bands just with look at all these 7 t-shirt designs, haha. And meanwhile, it's like, okay, what are we doing for this tour? You know, it's like a traveling Etsy store, right? But anyway, I thought that was the fun little nuzzle tidbit.
That is a deeper brotherhood than a lot of things could be. I mean, really, you know,
Eskimo brothers for vehicles.
Exactly. I guess. Exactly.
So what was it like? What is it like 94, 95 that the record that No Love Like That came out?
That record was a little bit late.
Fall for Now. Fall for Now. My bad. Sorry.
Yeah. I was thinking that was summer of
95.
95. Yeah.
Because I was already, that's actually, I think it was late summer, early fall of 95 when I moved to the Bay, when I finally moved to Oakland.
Right. Okay.
That makes sense.
It was late summer of 95 when we recorded it, and it came out soon after that. We've had to do a lot of, we've been doing a lot of, for lots of reasons, a lot of timeline building the last year or so. And it's funny. I'm always telling the kids now, insofar as there are paper flyers, but through whatever way you advertise the show, put the year on it. We spent so much time.
Thank you.
Have you gone through this?
Yes. I always was like, hey, can we put the year on it? I'm like, why? I'm like, can we just do it, please? Can you just, it makes life so much easier later on.
It's not so formal, like you're writing a check. Like, why would you include, you know, the fullness? But October 6th would do it or whatever. But then we spent so, and we've had to look at all this forensic evidence surrounding every flyer as we've tried to figure out what happened when.
You play the same city the same month multiple years, and you're like, I don't know which year this is.
Right. And my correct memories in general surrounding this record were that we had to hurry, which was no big deal in general, but it was rushed in a lot of ways. But then when I played it again recently, and I've put it on here and there at times and over the years, but when I played it, sat down and really listened to it leading up to this reissue, I was like, we sound kind of, for us, like really good. Like, but the songs also had this pep and fire to them and togetherness. And I was like, my memory was that we had to hurry up and finish it to leave for tour. Sounds like, like that's what happens all the time. Right. And it was, I'm like, this sounds like a band that has been on tour for a while, you know, which is always the best, right? When you record that way. I mean, sometimes that's, we all know, in our own bands or others, exactly, where you might get a song. This was always true of Watt's bands, especially Firehose, speaking of Mike Watt. You would play, the recording would be the song would be a certain pace, and then so if you would hear it live a few months later, and it was almost always faster.
It was
like very different.
Like somebody forgot they had a cake in the oven or something, right?
And that comes from playing stuff a ton, playing stuff every night, you know, with nerves and everything else, and which is the only real practice, right? And the only way to really get songs in order. And so, you know, when you follow this model of write then record. So anyway, I realized which makes me happy to hear, you know, that this is these songs were, you know, some of them were unfinished. Like I didn't finish writing words until the moment, you know, I went on the mic, but they were at least, you know, it was clear that we'd been playing together a lot in the run up. So anyway, it turns out that our friend Drew Gilbert, who was in a lot of bands, he was in a band, Fifth Cuss Bluff, that played with us on the tour we were coming back from. He was leaving for like a fellowship in Europe, and he was the guy who was putting his label was putting it out. So the rush was before he left the country for a long time. So and it was so sure, weirdly so weirdly urgent that we ended up having to put the recording. It was on some, I don't know my audio stuff very well, but it was on a real reel, like a 2-inch reel or whatever that recorded. Yeah, but then we had it spent time on a cassette before it went to mastering.
It's interesting because the true analog, you know, where it's all analog is that you put it, you drop it to 1/4 inch and then from 1/4 inch, you master it off the tape.
Right.
But, and then they usually carve the lacquer, but it's interesting because that's like LPs are like out of favor in the world at large, not in like the punk rock world, not in like the world of DIY. But I mean, when I worked it, cause I worked at the 4th best record store out of 4 in Berkeley, which was Tower Records.
Yeah.
And we sold CDs, you know, we didn't sell, if people want records, they go to Leopold's. You know, that was our store.
Sure.
And like we sold CDs for everything. But that said, there was still appetite for vinyl for people that actually were in the scene and cared, as long as they had a turntable. And then that kind of waned for a while, and then it came back big time, like bigger than it ever did before.
Right.
But there was definitely an interim period where it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna throw this to a DAT.
Yeah.
Format of the future that will always be around. Mm, okay.
Where was the tower in Berkeley? I have to pause. And was it on Telegraph with
Telegraph and Durant? Durant, right? I haven't thought about that address in forever. But
I'm sure I grudgingly passed through it once or twice, but I can't place it.
That's. I mean, that was. I mean, that's formative for me, right? That's because that's how I found out about all my about music and stuff. Because I didn't, you know, I just the fact that like you could. Hear music for free.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. There were listening stations. And also Tower had a magazine that in the back had, and this was before I really scene reports. It had city by city scene reports.
Yes.
And that became so essential. You would go to, you know, Seattle or San Diego, whatever. And that was became before I was sort of in touch enough to with folks to be getting my hands on zines. And we didn't even get the LA Weekly in our part of Los Angeles for you know, a long time. And so, you know, that was the thing. You go to straight to the back of that Tower magazine. And I know I'm trying to think of the name of the actual magazine too.
Cause Pulse or something. Is that it? Was it Pulse?
I think it might've been Pulse.
Cause there's also Bam. There's Bam magazine. Because that's the first time I heard of Smash Mouth, much to my chagrin. Before they even had a big hit. Like they were on a Train and Smash Mouth jock. And I'm like, both these bands are terrible.
It's funny too. The Tower and Barnes and Noble and Guitar Center are all places that like I can think of that we just hated so much, and that. But then, as they started to disappear, it was like, hang in there. You're an institution.
It almost becomes. Yeah, you're right. It almost becomes like. It's like that. The whole fetishization of Blockbuster. Right, they made
Blockbuster. Blockbuster was you'd be embarrassed to go into a Blockbuster.
That was the enemy. That was like Walmart or something. Sure. But now you're like, you know, there's, and it's funny because everyone is like all nostalgic and wistful for it, and they get Lloyd Kaufman from Troma, and he's like, it's like the hell with Blockbuster.
Right,
they practically ruined us. Right. Like the one dissenting opinion, which I thought was hilarious.
And Guitar Center has an odd role because it got better in a weird way, like it bridged it was the metal kids, especially like the elite, like Yngwie Malmsteen, right?
Shredder styles. Yeah,
and every worker there was a shredder of one sort or another. Mm-hmm. And to go there with any kind of other, you know, you were kind of shunned if you went there with another purpose. I went there looking for mandolin strings once and was literally laughed at for that. Now they have several varieties. You know what I mean? They've broadened, just become the music store, and actually they play the role that a lot of those places did. You know?
They've met the moment in a way that, like, you know, Sam Ash, I think, was some of the older ones.
Right.
They just didn't.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it's worth. And you with Guitar Center, it's like, it's always going to be the same everywhere you go. It's not going to be great, but they're going to have the same selection of you know, strings, or, you know, I used to be, you know, the nice thing about Boss pedals, anywhere you go, they got them.
Right. And I remember when I was, and it was a post like Nirvana thing where they would suddenly start having like jazz masters and Jaguars,
yeah,
and stuff like that, and pedals, like they'd have that you could finally like find like the Big Muff pedal there, which would have been unthinkable right. Then like not long before.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They met the moment a little bit. Anyway, Guitar Center, everybody, welcome our new sponsor.
There we go. I'm sure there's plenty of things that are terrible. I'm still, you know, I'm sorry, not to off track there. We were,
I no, it's, a, it's fine. The show's free form. This isn't fresh air, dude. It's fine.
But I did go probably to Tower and bought the $10 metal cassette. Metal is in, you know, like,
oh, that, yeah, yes,
the advanced one.
Yes, you know? I know exactly the ones you're talking about. Yeah.
So this record, passed through that before it got onto vinyl. I was still perfectly good with it, but you know, but it just that just has made it so, ripe for a reissue more than most things. Whereas it goes beyond just having something that, you know, where this is not like the, you know, the third remastering of Rumors or something where, you know, there's an actual reason to do it. Like
there's
actual stuff to clean up. That's not just, you know, charming, you know, like
it's going through a whole nother format originally that just not doing that. You're, you know, there's not going to be like this frequency loss. Like that,
right?
You would be
right.
That's huge, and it sounds. I mean, and like first, when I first heard Nuzzle, it was on a tape I taped off someone else. You know,
because
that's what we did back then. It was like we didn't even think Fidelity. What are you talking about? You know, like I remember first time I heard like How Soon Is Now. I actually thought the tape was jacked up. I was like, oh, what's going on? Oh no, it's supposed to sound like that. Okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know what? I the Minutemen. I think about some of the stuff that they were willing to put. You know, some of the really early stuff, especially that they were willing to put to record, you know, I was like, in the bar, I'm like, there's no low bar as far as, you know, the lo-fi level.
Yeah.
What for me, and I'm so bad at recognizing it. And this is one of the reasons why we have really good roles. It was true then, and it's true now. We have really good roles where when we're discussing like the remastering, I know that it needs to be done. And I suppose it sounds better, but I don't know what the opposite of an audiophile is, but it's audio. Phobe or something?
Audio proletariat.
Right. So yeah, exactly. So I'm like, I don't know. My job is media relations and
sure. Yeah. I mean, everyone's got a role to play. Right? Great.
And then I'll try to pretend to take part in the discussion on, you know, how the mix sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes no. And it does sound really cool, you know, and it's one of those things where, you know, I've had a lot of folks come on the show where it's just like, oh, this is being, you know, just taken out of like obscurity and like put into a format that people can actually engage with now. Like it exists for people to engage with now, which is huge. Right. And sometimes it strikes a chord. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's just for the people that were there and they, you know, it's like, oh, wow, this sounds awesome. I remember this sounding much worse than this, you know?
Right. Right.
And there's something to be said for that as well, you know, because like, you know, when you're a kid, what do you know from like making records, right? Nobody's sitting there like being like, well, here's what you got to do, and you want to make sure you take time with this. Yeah, that was no. I guess now you could just go to YouTube University, but not at the time you couldn't.
Right. Certainly not. Yeah, you just learned what you learned from your friends, and that was mostly it.
Yeah. So all right. So it's an 8-song record, right? And it's definitely. Yeah. Capturing the moment, you guys are, you know, going up and down the coast. You're playing shows. You're trying to find common cause different places. What are you like playing like Who's Cafe and stuff like that? Like I'm trying to think of like other good late 90s places.
Yeah. That was we played Coos one of our very last shows. It was weirdly off the. It was a really fantastic show too. It was
Santa Ana, right? If I remember right,
Santa Ana.
It
evaded us for some reason.
Yeah.
Jabberjaw was our big place in LA. Not that I think we might have only played there two or three times, but that was like the goal place. That was like playing like the Forum or something for us. Like that was
everything. Right. Yeah, that's the mountaintop. Yeah.
As long as we can play there. And we visited for the first time like 2 years earlier to see Jesus Lizard, but like it was still it had been every good musical moment had come there in the years between. So that was huge. And it wasn't like a home base for us or anything. In LA it was a real range. The Smell, the early versions of The Smell, which still exists.
The smell does still exist. Yeah.
Amazing
that like, and granted, it's in the second location it's in, but I mean, that location, they've been in the location for what feels like decades now.
I still do think of the first one sometimes, the North Hollywood one.
Yeah, everything around it is different now.
Yeah.
Everything, but it's still around. I mean, we played there. Well, I guess it was right before COVID hit. So 2019 is the last time that was there. But I was like, it's the same.
Yeah, it's crazy that it's the same. Super relevant, though. It doesn't feel like a place that's there as a relic or retro.
No.
Like, it's like the kids play there all the time. And my kids learned about it without my mentioning it.
Al's Bar. Was that? Did you guys ever play Al's Bar?
Al's Bar. I don't think we ever played Al's Bar. Oh, it was wonderful. That was a place that, you know, the whole place was like a bathroom, but the bathroom.
Oh my God. Yeah. It was like the West Coast CBG. But
it's actually a tour of that is a really good taste and smell of. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, you want to play rock and roll, kid? Huh? All right. Prove it. But peace and love, you know. This, when you're like in your 20s, you're like, great, this is awesome.
Right.
Now it's like, let's play somewhere else.
We have a funny relationship with Santa Cruz where, because we never, I don't think we, it was, there really weren't many places that were official to play, you know? I met a band from there recently of young people who, and there's the Catalyst is the big.
Catalyst has been around for forever.
And it's an institution. At the time I had scorn for it. I would appreciate it now. It's the place like where like Neil Young will decide if he wants to play like a one-off with Crazy Horse or something, he'll play there. And but it's a lot, definitely a lot more jammy, a lot more hip. But like I said, it was very Santa Cruz.
The logo is like the freaking Fillmore style, you know, like wearing acid, everybody. Oh, great, okay,
yeah. So we'd go see. So I saw Sonic Youth there and Public Enemy and stuff, and it was that kind of smaller city thing where you could see bands that would play much bigger places in other cities, at least there. That was the upside of it.
That's what I ended up doing. The times I went to the Catalyst were like, oh, you know, they're playing like the Fillmore or something in San Francisco. Like, all right, let's go down to Santa Cruz and see them at the Catalyst. It'd be like a better show, you know?
I'm sure you've seen this on your own tours. You'll see like the following week somebody playing in some small city where you're like, well, you're playing in the same place as them.
Right. And you're like, how is that possible?
Yeah, exactly. In a big city, they're playing like the Palladium and you're playing like a house, right?
There's
an annex to the Catalyst where like this band just plays, and that's like, oh, that's what we needed, kind of. Not that we didn't lack for anything, but that's what we needed. If you've been to Minneapolis, if you played 7th Street Entry,
the 7th Street Entry, I was just gonna say this,
like, a great example of like that, you know, that Husker Du played the same place as Prince, sort of, right? Like, there was a door between them, but they were the same, different levels of the same place. And
Replicator played in 7th Street Entry once, and Sleater Kinney was playing at the main stage in First Avenue. We got to see him for free. It was great because you get to see like an awesome rock show for free,
and you get the wristband to go between them if you're playing in the small place, right? Yeah. So it's so good.
I felt pretty cool right then,
for sure.
2 weeks into a US tour,
for sure. Part of all this,
playing to like 7 people around, you know, around the country.
Yeah.
No, but it's funny you mentioned that because people, I think, focus on, you know, smaller secondary markets, I think they call it, right? That they need to have places to play, but they need to be places to play that are not just gigantic. I mean, places to play that are more intimate, that you can have growth, right? That you can have.
It's so awkward to be on a tall stage in a big rock club in a town when you've got your 20 people there. It just
looks like a wake. Everyone's just milling about. Yeah. You know, it's like,
even if they're into it, and the stage is above your head for some reason, even though the room is. Only holds 200 people or whatever it is. It's the worst. And I think that was part of why, you know, in Santa Cruz in particular, like we always played. You could have grown up, you know, you could have been there throughout our time there and even kind of been a fan of an adjacent music and not have. My wife will always say, you're from Santa Cruz from 1995. Did you know about? And I'm like, they're probably going to say no. I mean, as much as we were to the people who, you know, to certain people, we were kind of this institution and, you know, like sat sort of atop this group of friends, you know, and all of that. It was just never official venues. And so there was very little, like, you know, there was very little, it was flyers only, and those were usually hand passed. And
it was harder to find out about stuff, right? Yeah. And it was something where, and I feel like that you could say the same thing about Eugene. You could say the same thing about but lots of college towns where you kind of had to know somebody to be like, hey, come to this thing. Come to this thing. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And Eugene in particular is a trouble because like it could have been such a tour stop, and it can be. I don't know how it is now, but it was like we played there once or twice, and it was good, but like it's like this should be a thing. And it's so needed, you know, given how few places there are between.
I mentioned Eugene. We're playing there like 2 weeks or something along those lines. They put it on the tour stop. Let me tell you that for years I had a fatwa against Eugene because I was like, no. After the second time somebody, like, we had to cancel like a show because the promoter just, oh, I flaked. What? What do you mean you flaked?
Yeah.
You flaked. Like, you know how far we're driving away to do this? So I had Eugene just like banned for like years. Right. And then we did a tour with our friends at the Man Long. Like, oh, we have to play Eugene. I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I expect that show's going to be terrible. But it was really good. And then we played again. And it was really good. And it's like, okay, I guess like something changed that maybe they smoke 25% less pot there now. I don't know. But
yeah,
like,
yeah. And there was always, you know, we had a weird scorn for it too, but I always had a good time there. And, you know,
it was a fun city. It's just like, you wish there was some immediacy.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also, you know, my first thoughts were, oh, it's a big sports school and that's they're not going to have our crowd, but so is Austin. You know what I mean? Right. And so is Madison, Wisconsin. I mean, there, you know, the fact that a city, you know, a school has like, you know, jock vibes doesn't mean that there's not, you know, a huge population to come out and watch you.
But getting on the subject of Santa Cruz, it is weird that we think about like, oh, so-and-so, yeah, they're from here. Oh, yeah, yeah, so-and-so, they're from there. You know, like, you know, Monoman, oh, yeah, they're from Bellingham, you know, whatever. Bands from Santa Cruz, there really isn't like a lot of like what, I hear that, like what, Swingin' Utters, right? Common Sun Fire. I got two.
Common Sun Fire, who were a little bit younger than us and definitely part of friends that we didn't know super well, but definitely in exactly the same houses.
Right.
One of the reasons I went there is because one of the things that planted the seed was Camper Van Beethoven. In the 80s,
Beethoven, yes, of course,
UC Santa Cruz, and I remember thinking, and I had just moved to California, and I thinking that Santa Cruz was Santa Cruz Island, which is one of the Channel Islands here, and this is where
that's right. Well, yeah.
I thought the school was there, and I didn't realize it was a city, you know, a city further north. But that planted the seed. I loved them when I was 14 years old.
Sure.
And got a little bit more famous as Cracker, right? The guy
right.
Formed Cracker later. But they were just goofballs in kind of the best way, you know. And so I was, but still, and Gillian Welch, the Americana singer, went to school there around the same time. But no, there's not. It's a really good place to build a little scene, but for whatever reason, I mean, I know the reason now is it is just so expensive to live there that it does not lend itself to bands staying and thriving there.
Right. It's a gorgeous place to live, you know, but you're paying for it.
Yeah. And people just don't stay. I mean, our time there, you know, I know two people that from our time there that still live there, and they both have family homes there. You know, their parents both live there.
Yeah, and they probably wouldn't have the ability to do that otherwise. Yeah.
And it doesn't lend itself the way Olympia or Austin or whatever does to having kind of a longer term thing. It's really fun and not easy, but it's fun and it lends itself really well to building something up. And we felt like we really had a fun and thriving scene for the time it was happening. It's also kind of, you know, speaking of Eugene as a tour stop, and you mentioned earlier, you know, our set sort of having elements of kind of the Unwounds and such,
yeah, the Pacific Northwest,
and the Gravity Bands to the south, and that we were kind of physically lived that because we became an essential tour stop essentially, you know, for a while, and it began with I put on it was an Unwound show in the fall of 1993. When I first started to get really, really amped about, you know, we had just started as a band, and I put on a show at the Vets Hall in Santa Cruz. It was Unwound. It was Link, and a couple of locals and us opening the classic put on a show so your band can play first. But it was like, that was like, it was the greatest night of my life when it happened. And it might have been without even playing the show. I mean, everyone came and stayed at our, you know, punk house afterward and all of that. And it was, But once that happened, and it was just that one show, and the Kill Rock Stars bands from the north would come down. They all came down in the same van. Speaking of passing vans along,
that's right.
Slim Moon from Kill Rock Stars had an old Pacific Bell van. So it actually had the kind of the rubbed out. It's like when you see a cop car that's a former cop car. And every band would come down in it. So we had that van pulled up to our curb in Santa Cruz for that year or two, and it was a steady stream of Heavens to Betsy came, the proto, proto Steve Kinney. Godhead Silo, who we became good friends with. Just every Kill Rockstars band would come. And then the bands from the South started making it a stop, too. Anyhow, right. Garrow and Quick Attack Atawi came a little bit later. But so that was like, it was a perfect, so we kind of straddled those places. And then I don't think we would have done so well had we not been able to be kind of, you know, had that small pond with these passersby and the people we got to know and the people we got to play with after that and stuff like that. So it was, yeah, it was a magical place in that sense. We got to really, really create a scene again, that's really hard to make last. And, you know, sometimes because, you know, there weren't ways or we, in some cases we couldn't, we so often had house shows and stuff that, you could be accused of being a little bit, you know, secretive on purpose, right? Sometimes it was like, you're like, you're sort of this, you know, this like hipster elite show going on. And I'm like, I really do want all of you to know about it. I would, you know, I would drive around town like the Blues Brothers and announce it if I could, you know.
hear ye. Yeah, exactly.
We did end up having a place, some friends got a house that was in an odd part of town, kind of near the beach. We didn't go near the beach most of the time on that had a basement for some reason. There's so few basements in coastal California. It was just really bizarre, but it was a basement that was just made to be, a show place. It was just a perfect
set up for doing shows
down a little flight of stairs. And then it was just, and I would say like five of our 10 best shows were in that space. It just became our home club. Third Street House did. So we ended up, and that was a few years into our existence. But if I think back to my, you know, if I want to feel the vibe of being part of a show that was special, it's usually there. And almost all of our shows were, and I mean, we had a, I walked, my daughter's at UC Berkeley now, and I walked by the YWCA there. And that was, we had a show there that was just beyond memorable and perfect. So, and it was a lot of times it was the semi-official places like that, you know, Vets Halls, YMCAs, whatnot.
Sure, because those kinds of alt spaces, you know, if you get the right people and the right bands in there, it can feel like a stadium.
Yes, yeah, they absolutely can. And just the feeling of, the weird feeling of like we're doing something that's a little bit, you know, makeshift, that's a little bit illegal, that's a little bit, it's like that, it must be like the flash mob feeling of now that we come together and turn this into a magical club for an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And everyone gets to transcend a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, and that's something that's kind of interesting too, because there's not a lot of, I mean, there's zines, right? But I feel like a lot of that stuff didn't make it into the digital age, really. So it's sort of like every once in a while, someone like, hey, I found this. I'm going to scan it and, you know, put it on my Instagram page or something. And like, that's the best that you can get. But I feel like it was kind of word of mouth.
In that way. Overwhelmingly. Yeah.
And which is weird to think about, because it's just, I mean, it's just not how it is anymore. You know, even like the smallest band in the world, like, can have universal reach if, you know, the weather conditions are aligned exactly. And
And I'm glad we had that enough of a, you know, it's like, I compare it sometimes to like Sauron getting destroyed, but enough of it remained, right? And we had enough, there was enough remnant, thanks to George Chen and people like him, like the enough remnant of us through the years that it reached another shore where it could, you know, and a group of young people where it could sort of come back. I know this would have been so, you know, doing these reissues and you know, the possibility of, we've been practicing a little bit and all of that, that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, and that's right. And so that's something where, and that's the lovely thing about these reissues, right? Is that again, you're not only giving people that were there, you know, something to a nice keepsake that, like, presumably the people that were there, like, have, you know, straight jobs now and can afford to buy a reissue. Right. Yeah. Instead of like, oh, I spent all my money on beer, man. You know, okay, fine, right?
Yeah. I will tell you that people putting out the records now have significantly more money, even if it's just their little personal label, right? Like, I was to be told the cover of the, you know, whatever you want, colors, format, whatever. I'm like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Like, amazing. It used to be like, could we cut out, like, you know, we could do, cut up a magazine and maybe do that, you know, on cardboard or whatever, which was great in its own way, of course, but it's been really fun to have that, you know, have that
to give it a presentation that meets the music within, right? There's something to be said for that. I mean, and I'm always a big fan of, do it how you feel like it should be presented.
Yeah.
Right? Don't cut corners because you might regret it later. Sometimes you have to, but you know, you shouldn't have to. Put yourself in a position where you don't have to.
For sure. Yeah. And it's been, you know, I've been just surprised because I did assume, you know, and I, that the people who were listening to us still were all our old friends, or at the very least people from the past that we knew, you know, a little bit. And I've been talking about this a lot, but Spotify stats don't mean everything, but getting that report, which I didn't even know was a thing, you know, for a band like us, of who the listeners are and where they are.
Yeah, and here's someone in Australia, and here's someone.
Yeah, and the people our age are like, there's only about 2% of the people are our age. I mean, I should have known we don't have so many friends that the place could have run up like that. And, you know, the cities are kind of predictable, but there are surprises in that, too. You know, San Antonio, for some reason, I just assume like there's like one kid, you know, who is into it.
Just found it randomly, right? Yeah.
But, you know, and a weird Bay Area absence, but I think it's because it was listed by city and there wasn't.
Yeah.
There's not like one place.
Also, a lot of people got priced out, man. I mean, that's we lived in 2017.
I should have thought of that. Yeah. You
know? I mean, it was just sort of like, all right, well, if we stay here, it's going to cost three times as much. So,
right. So, we were always enthusiastic for whatever we have wanted just to get back together. You know, like we've discussed often, like, just literally get back together and hang out. Like
we're
my brother, I see, but we're based between the Bay and LA now, two of us here and two of us there. And I just wanted to be with just the four of us in a hotel room for a night, you know, and to watch a movie. Like we actually were talking about doing just that as a hangout thing. And it turns out we're doing that. Like it's this Saturday we're doing that, but we're actually playing too. Which again, so the joy of that is kind of the best part.
Yeah. So how's it coming back to the music? Like as like not a moment in time captured and recorded, but as a entity that like lives, that is like the humans within making it.
Yeah. It's this will be the third time. We kind of just did slowly. The first time was a little over a year ago. And then, you know, without that was just to see if we even wanted to try to see, it would have been an easy thing. Just, you know, I almost hoped it wouldn't work because then we could just forget about it. And then it was remarkably similar from the first moment. And, you know, the only challenge was remembering parts, you know, but it was definitely not one. There's a kind of a weird thing where like people are like almost a little bit more skilled. Not that anyone, you know, my brother's certainly been playing guitar all this time. And I've singing like a choir now where I learned to breathe and stuff like that. Right. In a way that
I don't think they teach you in punk rock. Yeah.
You never breathe. In fact, it was considered sellout to breathe.
Yeah, exactly. I wrote no space to breathe in here. That was really dumb of me. Okay. You know,
but we got along remarkably well, especially for a band with brothers in it. I mean, it's unheard of, right? Yeah, even bands where the brothers don't fight, like Van Halen, the band fights all the time. Like something about having two brothers in a band, like it's just like the biggest recipe for disaster. And we just get on so well. But then, it was apparent almost immediately that we were going to have to. This was something we were going to have to do something with because it was so good so fast, and you know. Again, it was just remembering, like, you know, I didn't have lyrics written down and I remembering how stuff went. And that's still going to be the challenge here is like, you know, because a lot of the format, it's not, we weren't that avant-garde, but you definitely don't just go chorus versus chorus, you know?
It's not just like, you know, the Ramones or something, like Peace and Love to the Ramones. I love them, but
the feeling is just incredible. And there's nothing like it. I mean, nothing like it. I've done made other kinds of music. I've been on stage in other ways and it's just nothing, but there's nothing that was ever going to feel quite like this. And it was just, it felt so right. You know, there's a little bit of a, you know, not just that we're old, but you know, I do have friends and I respect them and I respect them very much who are from the time and the scene. And we're like, this is just so not, it was what it was about getting back together later, you know, 30 years later. And I totally buy that. But I did have a broader change. Just thinking about people broadly who we kind of want to see retire in whatever way, like whether it's a, you know, like, and I'm like, I did, and this kind of goes naturally along with, this is probably when I was turning 40 or so. I'm like, you know what? Go out kicking and screaming. and do the thing that makes you, like, we have this expectation that people should stop doing the thing that makes them happiest for the last, like, 50 years of their life, right?
Right, because some arbitrary age requirement or something.
Like, we don't want to see an athlete looking flabby and aging, you know, you should get out of here. And it's like, well, no, he's got 50 years to do nothing else. So anyway, so that feel, I kind of, you know, reconciled with that. And also the idea that the younger people were listening makes it feel more vital than just say, let's get back together for a class reunion or at our friend's wedding or something. And
I mean, dude, it's very real. Like, you know, people that like my friends versus people that listen to my band, you know, it's like there is overlap, but it's not like, they're different circles. And it's, that's just the kind of the way it is that for me, I never stopped and kept going with it, but that's the nature of it. And like, you know, there are always going to be like the true heads that are, you know, going out to shows and, you know, don't GAF about any of it. And there's going to be people that like, they tap out because they're, I got mortgages. I can't be out till the, you know, break of dawn and like whatever. Okay. Well, I get it. You know, you can still listen to the records, but that's, you know, we live in a world where punk rock is getting older now. You know, that was not a thing that has ever happened. And so we get to see what that feels like and there, I think there are sniff tests and there are times it's like, all right, maybe it's time to like stop the reunion tour now. You know, but
There are definitely, I'm definitely like, we're not playing to five people more than one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's when we're like, there needs to be a demand and that shouldn't be the fuel. And that's not when you're younger. Right.
Yeah.
It's just not 5,000 anymore. It's probably, you know, 50 or...
Yeah, there's a point that feels comfortable with it. So where's everybody living now?
I'm in South Pasadena, California, it's again another LA city that feels far, but is right in the middle of everything. I work downtown.
Little old lady from Pasadena. That's 10, what everybody 15, knows.
You're right, exactly. And then Pasadena proper is right up here. I'm not too far from the Rose Bowl. So I'm here, the closest to LA proper. Rick, our drummer, is in greater LA area, city of Azusa, a city that has everything. Okay. In the USA. It's like, you know, he's probably a 40-minute drive from me here. Sammy, bass player, is in San Jose.
Okay.
My brother Nate's in Berkeley.
Okay. All right.
And it's been, there wasn't a
getting together to
in the same town.
Yeah.
But it's
pretty
special. Yeah, no, we've been in various combinations, but we hadn't all four been in a room since the band stopped.
Well, and that's kind of what I was driving at, is the logistics of, you know, not being in the same house, not living down the street from each other. Yeah, you know, there's more of a sweat equity to even just get in the same place to do it, you know, let alone to what happens after that.
Yeah, we had a thing at the beginning and the end of Nuzzle where we were the first couple of years and the last couple of years. Everyone did end up moving to Santa Cruz. You know, after I was the only one there and they all came and moved there and we had, you know, all that time where it was relatively easy. But then we have spent a lot of our existence having to figure out how we're going to get together and practice for 20 minutes before the show and then play the show and then before everyone has to turn around and go back. And we're experiencing a little bit of it now as we try. We are a little bit more capable, but people also have like children and real jobs now in a way that's hard. So
right,
we are going through. It's one of the reasons why we you know, but George like would set us up things and we would be bad at keeping, you know, this was more in the later years when I had moved back down here it's hard and we're not the most like, you know, logistically on top of things. But we did the practice we're having Saturday. This is something I wish we'd done a long time ago. And partly it's just the existence of like, I'll get to this part in a second, but we're meeting in San Luis Obispo. We have an exact halfway point. We did this last time. We learned that we can still spend a night in a room together, sleep in a room together and get on fine.
Right. You know, important distinction. Yes.
control. It's a hotel room in this case, but you know, it's weird to share, you know, with non spouses or girlfriends to share a hotel room, but it's like, it's something that we're still well equipped to do. And so we were just meeting there. And I think one of the reasons we didn't do it is I don't know. I feel like there's just this abundance of cheap by the hour practice spaces now that just didn't exist.
Yeah, before. Absolutely.
And I'm like, did they exist? But we just thought of the Maybe money as too much when it was $20 an hour, because that would have been too much. But right, now it's like, it's such a dream, especially because the gear is all there even. You know what I mean? Like, it's
just, you don't like, have to do anything. Just like plug
PA.
In.
And like, we didn't even have a PA for practice. I might plug into a little lamp or something or just yell. Like, So it's like, it actually makes that part makes all of it easier. I mean, you know, we would have been like, well, we could meet in San Luis Obispo, but where and how, you know, what would we even do when we're there? And that's true of going to either, you know, to the other town in any case.
So two things, right. It's such a boon. It makes life a lot easier. I remember being that Nuzzle played the first Yo-Yo Go-Go, right? In Olympia. Yep. What was that like? Because that I feel like was a pretty legendary event. I was not there, by the way, but
yeah,
like I've heard from so many people again, like about it was 1 year before I would have been able to even attend, even if I had known about it, which I didn't.
Right. And then I didn't, we were three of them, but I did not go to the International Pop Underground Festival, which was a one-off, which was kind of the version that, you know, there's always like the one that, you know, everyone the person that was at the thing wasn't at the other thing.
Yeah.
It was, it was incredible. It was such a deal. We were already going to be on tour. I think the idea was that we would go on tour and be there just to see it in that first one, which was summer of, was that 94? Yeah. It was summer of 94.
Yeah.
But we were connected to all these bands through, I think even Lois Mafio, who was part of it, a duo with Pat Maley, who took that thing on. They were in this a group called weirdly called Courtney Love together. I don't know the story.
The band Courtney Love.
And it was before I learned that name before her, or I can't remember. It was weirdly simultaneous.
Yeah, and it was in that kind of you couldn't even find that you couldn't just go to Google to find it out. It was like I don't know,
the backstory of it. I know, and they were and they knew she. I knew Lois was friends with Kurt, and they were in Olympia, and so I was like, you know, anyway, but. There was a cancellation, not the very last second, but fairly late. And we knew we were going to be doing it, but we had a major, we had a van disaster with the van. It was two vans before the one you ended up with, where we were in Seattle playing and with friends a few days before. And it was in Portland that it got left. Anyway, gas started pouring out of the gas tank as we were driving, and they had to do a major reconstruction of the gas tank. Anyway, the gear was stuck down there. And we were, and so I remember having to hitch a ride down and get back in time to play. And it was like finale of the movie level, you know, and of course in your mind at the time, this is the most important thing in the world. Nothing will matter if we don't make it to play this. And I swooped in at the absolute last second. It was actually probably better. I've had this happen with venues, as you might have yourself, where it's kind of better if you walk right onto stage and don't have time to look around and consider who's watching.
I mean, you don't have to even get to think about it. Yeah.
You're not like fearing one particular set of eyes that you see in advance or noting who's there.
I did that at South by Southwest once. And it was like, you were so stressed. You don't even think about it. Right. You're like, all right, now, then go, let's go. Right. We're doing it. Yay. So-and-so was there. Where?
And I do remember I was faint from a lack of food and water because again I was no time to stop for any of it, but there was that like kind of K Records and like Olympia kind of loviness. So when I was like I was kind of right after we'd finished and we did our usual like you know really really you know really really jump around really heavily physical thing, like I was very nearly passing out, and they were the best possible people to have around.
Because they're gonna take care of you.
Right, exactly. There were chips in my hands immediately, and you know, a bottle of water. There's this band, Hush Harbor played right before us. John Atkins, who went on to be in a couple of other bands, 764 Hero being the best known of them.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, fantastic. I met him at that very moment and became friends then. Because he had just played and was standing in the wings. So it was great. And then we were on the album, so we got to go back up and mix it with everybody, and it felt being in that, you know. Well, there's questions now of whether you can say, okay, we played with, I'm sure you've gone through this, we played with whatever act. Yeah. Uh-huh. Because what if they played, you know, you were on the same festival bill as them and they played 3 days later.
I mean, if you're booking, hey man, nobody's asking
the question. Ticket, right? But we played and it was good. It was nice. It was definitely nice for us for the recognition and to be able to be on that comp and all the rest of it. We went the 2 years that followed. We were back up there, but we played at this art gallery that was it was not an official part of the festival, but it was on the eve, and we did it. And those were two of the best shows we ever had anywhere. And it's perfect because all the people are there, but they're not sick of anything yet. No one's tired. They're just perfectly poised. You know, it's like those are the only two times I think we ever played Encores, were those two gallery shows, on the eve of those two yo-yos. And yeah, that was like that. We were happier to have done it that way than to have played the festival. I also don't quite remember who was what year, because Elliot Smith played one year.
Yeah.
Didn't fit the venue at all. Like, just sat on the edge of the stage, you know, and that same, yeah. him and Nick Drake never felt the audience, you know, they could be great live, but it's definitely just, not.
They like, have their own thing. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So this is great. Let's talk real briefly about Dying Californian. Too, yeah. Which, because I think some people didn't necessarily realize, because again, this is like the internet days, not internet as we know it now, where it's like, oh, it's this band. It's very different. Okay. Yeah. And I knew Dying Californian because of Nuzzle, but I think it's sort of like that band kind of had its own sound. It had its own, you know, I feel like there was that early 2000s, there was kind of people discovering, hey, there's cool stuff that's in country music.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah, there was and we had definitely like, I mean, it was part of our youth in some ways, but we had definitely, my brother and I definitely caught that bug really seriously of George Jones and Hank Williams and stuff like that. Sure. And we were far from, you know, and the other guys didn't have it as much. And Dying Californian was far from a pure country thing, but it was,
it was indie rock. Yeah. Kinda, I guess what later became those all country, you know?
Right. And it was, it was a natural thing in a lot of ways. There was a lot that went into it. I mean, it didn't feel, we had some later Nuzzle shows that weren't as, they were fine in retrospect, but it felt like we had kind of exhausted that a little bit.
I
was heading into graduate school and having a child and we were just listening to very different kinds of music. We did end up playing a couple of, the band started to morph a little bit. Nuzzle did at the end, and we did end up on some sort of full on hardcore bills that, you know, felt
right.
You know, we had it in us when we needed to bring it out, but it felt wrong at that latter stage. So we just decided to break up and get back together immediately. You know, it was the same guys. I went from singing to I could play chords on a keyboard, and so I got a Rhodes stage piano. And part of the idea with it was that we would be doing it, it would be a little more mellow in the sense that I wouldn't have to be there. That was one thing. Again, I was in grad school, I had a child, I was in LA, they were all up north, and they could play without me if
you were tying your availability to the success of the band.
Exactly. Yeah, sure. So they could do that. They could do little acoustic things. And then I could, you know, have a secondary role. I wasn't writing as much. And then it allowed my brother and I, and we were doing it in Nuzzle, but we loved singing harmonies together. And that was kind of a lot of that band, which I always really liked. We never, and we did, you know what, even though that was the plan was for it to be a casual thing, our sensibility where if you have a thing like this, you need to go not just play shows, but go on tour, was a thing. So we did a couple of tours with the Dying Californian, put out a couple of records. There was one a little EP that we kind of advertised as the first Dying Californian record, but the songs were written as Nuzzle. We've reclaimed them now because we want to play them from the first band. No one cares anyway. We can play whatever we want from either band, but like there are a couple of gems that way. So
it lasted,
you know, it was another 7 or 8 years. It did seem we'd never quite found our audience with that band. And a lot of some of the older people, I do remember playing one show, the first show we played in LA, and it being a lot of our old, and there was disappointment. You know, it was just people just, it wasn't what people expected.
There were no booze,
but they were sitting at the edges of the room. The people who were standing in front were sitting at the edge of the room by the time we were done. And so I'm really proud. I love listening to that stuff now. And there was, my brother who was already, you know, his songwriting was already great, but he was also writing all the lyrics for that band. And there were most of them. And they were really, fantastic. So it felt like this weird, you know, semi, you know, and then in the end, I don't think we ever decided to stop doing that, but I kind of, you know, everyone else had kids and was doing more careery jobs and stuff like that. And so it kind of came to a natural dissipation.
Yeah. And I think that's something where, you know, sometimes that happens, and, you know, it doesn't mean that the music was, you know, didn't do what it's supposed to do or whatever. It's like, it like maybe it was not the right time, or yeah, the people in the band were not in the right place for it to take, you know, and sometimes it's okay to something exists outside.
If the right people, then it would have worked a little bit better. But again, we didn't have direct access in that way. We had our network were all a little bit more punk based. And but you know what? The two albums that I really love, and most of my life, most of the time since, I would have preferred to listen to those. Right now, I'm on a nuzzle kick in a weird way, just because it's stuck in the air and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm enjoying it quite a bit now, and I hadn't listened to them forever. But it,
it's probably a little more catharsis too than the Dying Californians, which, you know, like, whatever, nothing, no shame in the game.
Yeah.
It's a different kind of catharsis, you know.
But that stuff's still out there too, so it can have its moment. You know, if it wants to, and it's there, and I love a lot of those songs.
Getting back to Nuzzle, as we sort of close this out, any kind of surprises with revisiting the material live where you're just like, what was it? What was that? Like, why was it? Why was that the thing? Or was it, did it all kind of snap back fairly quickly?
Most of it did. I mean, this album is a weird mix. It's got the four or five, kind of, I don't want to say best or most popular, but some combination of our four or five, like, really key songs. The ones that tended to open shows, the ones that tended to close the shows are all on this record. Yeah. And then there's like three or four that never really got into the regular live circulation. And a part of, you know, for whatever reason, that are weirder. And playing through some of those, that's been a lot of what the hell was this thing? But also, like, why didn't we, this deserved getting a little more play than it got, you know?
Right.
Or we should have done more with this one, or that we should. And sometimes it was because we didn't quite, it wasn't quite written enough, but there's been a lot of that.
Sometimes you don't know at the time too, just in retrospect, oh, that was this. And you're like, we didn't know at the time.
Yeah, for sure.
No, for whatever reason.
So we're definitely gonna look closely at a couple songs that might get played live for the first time. Or I'm sure we played everything at least once, you know.
Yeah.
But that might get brought out and played more.
Are there gonna be some more live outings in the future? Then, so you get, this is one coming up, right? So there's that. But
we've got like a booking agent now, which we never had before. Again, these things coming so easily now. It was like that. I don't know what it is. Like, we kind of seem to almost have our pick a little bit.
Yeah.
Of like, it's so. Though there's going to be more happening. We need to kind of decide. I mean, it's definitely not going to be,
6 week
four month tours.
Yeah.
But we also, if we're doing it, we're not going to stay in town, and not if there's shows available to us in New York or in the Midwest or whatever, you know, America, all the places. We'd really love to get on some of these, even though they're not always the most fun festivals that involve younger bands too.
Sure.
Just to be able to get in the mix that way. And so I do think that we are going to have we wouldn't be going through all this just to do it one or two more times, you know.
Here's the museum piece, you know, the exhibit opens at 8 a.m. It's more like this is going to be a living thing that has potential for next chapter.
I would expect it to be a regular for the next year or two, for it to be a regular thing, at least till we play everywhere we want to, and as long as the opportunities are there and as long as there's somebody showing up.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Andrew, it's been great, man. Thank you so much for doing it. It's been great talking to you about the band. I hope that a lot of times one of the goals I have with the show isn't just for people to show up for the bands that they already know, but show up for the bands that, like, maybe they don't know, and so that they can learn a little something. And so I certainly hope that happens here, as I do always when that happens. Last thing, it's the only canned question I ever ask, and you can choose to interpret this however you like. Why do you do what you do?
I'm straddling between friends and love. I guess love is the word, because that brings, as Santa Cruz hippie as it sounds, because it's the feelings I have for my bandmates, but also the way that gets expressed through the music. So it's not just the hangout. It's the emergent transcendent feeling that comes from our gelling together.
Andrew Dahl, thanks so much, man. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thank you, Conan.
Take care, brother.
Take care.
All right, there he goes. Go get that reissue. You can go to the solidbreastrecords.com, nuzzleband.bandcamp.com. You can get the Follow For Now 30th Anniversary Edition that we were talking all about there, as well as the Junk of Myth 92 to 95 comp, all kinds of good stuff there. Yeah, let's hear something off the reissue. I will play a song. So let's hear, oh yeah, we'll hear Newfoundland, aka Newfies. Hold on a second, I'm gonna throw that on right now. There you go. It was Newfoundland. That's A Follow For Now, the 30th Anniversary Edition by Nuzzle. Featuring my guest for tonight, Andrew Dalton. You go to nuzzleband.bandcamp.com, solidbrassrecords.com. Find out all more about that, all things Nuzzle. Oh, there's a Nuzzle Instagram as well. So if you're on that platform, follow them. I think it's, I want to say it's Nuzzle_band. that sounds right. That sounds appropriate. Yes, yeah, it's Nuzzle Band. That's correct. Hey, this has been Code New Transportonic Reversal. Thank you very much for listening to it. The show airs Thursdays, 8 Eastern, 7 Central, 6 Mountain, 5 Pacific. Generally. Streaming live to YouTube and Twitch. Podcast later everywhere. Always free. No ads. No sponsors. No kidding. But if you like the show and you want to get episodes sooner and help support, $1 a month at patreon.com/protonicreversal. Gladly achieves that goal. So please do so if that is within your ability. Thanks for folks liking, subscribing your platform of choice. Mr. and Mrs. America. Sharing them around these episodes. You can leave it a review. All that helps people discover the show and helps beat back the almighty algorithm, and it is greatly appreciated.
I've got 50,000 watts of power.
We got there's a bunch of stuff coming up. Cool Protonic Versus stuff. Follow us on social media and all that. Going to be a little bit of a break for a couple weeks while I'm out on tour, but there's some cool stuff. So just stay tuned to it. Always appreciate everyone. Come out to those shows, too. Anything else? No, I think that's it. So stay safe out there, all right?
Can you hear me now?
And check
out on Route 128, it's dark and lonely. I got my radio on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Welcome to my top 10. I'd like to thank our sponsor. But we haven't got a sponsor. Not if you were the last man on Earth. She was prepared to prove it. This one goes out to a special girl. There is no special girl! It's the end of radio! The last announcer plays the last record. The last what? Leaves the transmitter. Circles the globe in search of a listener. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Is it really broadcasting if there's no one there to receive? It's the end of radio. As we come to the close of our broadcast day, radio. Can you hear me now? This had been a real emergency!